Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 2006, is the first of 11 conversations with former Secretary of State George Shultz. This conversation with University of Chicago law professor and current Brookings Institution senior fellow Kenneth W. Dam describes Shultz's experience with the Reagan administration and what has transpired since his time as Secretary of State. We hope you enjoy and be sure to stop in each week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Well, George, it's just great being here with you here today, and I'm told my role is to ask you a few questions, so I hope I get to
quarrel
with the
Once a law professor, always a law professor.
Right. And they're going to be rather general questions, but I hope the conversation is not general, so I hope you'll give some examples. I think most everybody knows that you've had a wonderful career, a diverse career. You've had four cabinet positions, you've been an executive in business, you've been a dean of a great business school. Those are three different areas of life. And everybody knows that at the working level, business and government and the academic world are really quite different. But you've been in an executive position, and I wonder what the differences are from that perspective in those three different worlds.
I used to get asked that question phrased slightly differently by the students in the business school here. They'd say, you've managed in the government and universities and companies, so what's the difference? And I had an apocryphal answer and then a little longer answer. I'll give you both.
Okay.
The first one is that I quickly learned when I went to business that you had to be very careful when you told somebody who's working for you to do something, because the chances are very high that he or she would do it. Whereas in the government, you really didn't have to worry about
it. That's right.
People, if they didn't like it, they would leak it to a congressman or to the press or what. Things don't get settled so easily. And in the university, you're not supposed to tell anybody to do something in the first place. And then my longer explanation was that these are probably more or less appropriate. After all, in a university, what it's about is learning. And that's something a person does, or maybe a small group. But the essence of the thing is learning. So in a sense, it's an inverted pyramid. The basic unit of authority is the individual learner. And then everybody works for that person. And that creates an atmosphere in a university. So that's why you don't try to tell people to go learn something. It's just not in the spirit of the enterprise. And in government, you realize you're dealing with really big issues all the time. And even some issues that you sort of relegate, this isn't, are big by in any other standard. And so the idea of our founding fathers of checks and balances, which is almost by definition an inefficient way to do something, is a good idea. It slows things down, makes people think, challenges, and so that's the way government works. And a business is got, there's their policies and so on, but basically businesses are carrying things out, they're executing.
My observation in academia was that the deans, people like you, were working for the faculty from the faculty's point of view. But of course, they did hope that the dean did a few things like raise money and get other good faculty and so forth. But basically, they wouldn't tolerate too much independent policymaking from a dean on the whole. Did you find that true? Because you really changed the Graduate School of Business at the University of Chicago.
Well, I had a rule that faculty members are really interesting, charming people one by one. But you put them all in a room in a faculty meeting and you have big trouble. So I would have as few faculty meetings as possible and work the system one by one to find out what people were had on their minds and the sense of direction that I wanted to see us go, and generated support that way. And I had some strong people to work with. George Stigler, Milton Friedman took an interest. You remember when we had at the university the big brouhaha over the Dow Chemical interviewers?
Oh,
you remember
yes.
That? Well, this was at the height of the Vietnam furor, the Dow Chemical Company signed students up to be interviewed. That's the way it happens. Dow puts up a list and students sign up that they want to interview for Dow. So in effect, the students have invited Dow to come to the campus. And Dow made napalm. And that was one of the things that were being protested. So there was a big effort made to cause Dow to the invitation to be withdrawn. And I said, no. After all, you invite communists and Nazis and anybody can come. What's the matter with a legitimate defense contractor? And it was a big fight. You remember there were faculty meetings over it.
Oh, yes.
A couple of them. And on my side, I had George Stigler and Milton Friedman. And I didn't need anybody else, because they were eloquent. They put it as a free speech issue. And Edward Levy tried to get me to cancel. Ben Heineman, I remember, was a trustee. He said, I'll get the best suite in the Palmer House and provide limousines, and we'll take the students down to the Palmer House. And I said, no way, they're on the campus. And in the end, it went off okay.
Well, you know, some things never change, and a similar case with regard to recruitment by the military on campus just went to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court unanimously said that they had a right to do that. In essence, that's summarizing. Let's drill down a little bit on the government side of this, and because I'd like to talk to you basically about your government years. You were engaged deeply in both economic policy making and in foreign policy making. And I'd like you to comment, if you like, on the differences. So I've always thought that one distinctive thing about economic policy is that you at root have some principles of economics that underlay many of the decisions. And at least most economists, virtually all economists, will agree on the basic principles. It's harder to find that on the foreign policy side. And I wonder whether you think that is a valid distinction.
I think when I was in office and you were in office with me in the State Department, we actually did have an almost nonpartisan atmosphere for the most part. Mm-hmm. That is, people were in broad agreement on how we went about the Soviet effort. And the way we went about it in the Reagan administration was sharply different from what had come before, at least in our general conceptual outlook. We discarded detente, had a different concept. We discarded linkage. And when the Soviets shot down that airliner, Korean airliner, we led the charge against that. But we sent our negotiators back to Geneva. We didn't shut down everything the way Jimmy Carter had when they went to Afghanistan. So we had very different, but we had broad support for that. I think we did a lot of consulting with the Congress. They knew what was going on. But other than the fight over the Contras in Nicaragua, I think we had a broad consensus, and that's one reason why it worked pretty well.
Well, let me push back a little bit on that, not on the notion that we had less partisanship then than perhaps earlier and certainly later, but rather on the question of what the basic principles of foreign policy making, or national security policy making for that matter, are.
Well, I think one of them is that you have to realize that strength and diplomacy go together.
Right.
They're not alternatives, and people don't get it. I say strength without diplomacy is a wasting asset. Diplomacy without strength is a waste of time.
What about force and diplomacy?
Well, that's
same
the
thing.
Strength.
You got to use the force occasionally.
People have to think that you might actually use it. And there were two things in the Reagan administration that I think stood out in that regard in an odd way. When President Reagan stood down the air traffic controllers, it was a message around the world. Because everybody has their air traffic controllers and everybody knows how sensitive that is. And they asked for things that were out of line and then they struck violating their constitutional oath. And President Reagan fired them. Mm-hmm. And all around the world, people said, a man must be crazy to do that. the planes won't fly, but the planes did fly. And he kept them flying, and he won that. And it made an impact all around the world because of the commonality of the air traffic controller issue, that he wouldn't be held up. And then, of course, we did use American Armed Forces in the rescue operation in Grenada. Notice how carefully I phrased that.
Right.
Our lawyers tell me to do things like that. But at any rate, we used force. So people had to know that, yes, we would use force.
Let's talk, before we go to some more issues.
However, I would have to add the Reagan Doctrine, that was one of the underlying factors, was more in the line, if you are in a country and you're fighting for freedom in that country, we'll support you, but it's your country, you're doing the fighting, and we'll give you support, but we didn't put troops in.
Well, let's spend just a moment on economic policy making. It strikes me that it's changed enormously over the years. If you look at your experience as a Treasury and say compare them with some of the what's happened in the last decade or so. Now, I'm not quite sure why there's been a change. Is it because Washington has changed, because the problems have changed, or because the world has changed and we're more in a world economy than we felt we were, particularly before Camp David, which was in 1971?
Well, the world economy has grown more interdependent, that's for sure. And interdependent also has the last word in that phrase, dependence. Interdependence means you're more dependent on others. And in particular cases, that gets uncomfortable. Right now, we're very uncomfortable with oil and the high prices that are generating huge revenues for the countries that are basically enemies. My friend Jim Wilsey has said, this is the first war in history where we're financing both sides. And it's an irony. So yeah, things have changed. I think one of the things that's changed, and that it, which can be changed back, is the role of the Treasury Department. It's a great department, historic department. First department formed in the government. After all, you're not going to do much if you don't have money. And so the Treasury Department was a key. And when I was secretary, you remember, Ken, I had an office in the White House, and you were the full-time person minding the store there. So we had the Treasury Department was in the White House as well as the Treasury, and we basically coordinated economic policy on behalf of the president from the White House base. And I remember talking with Bob Rubin about it, long breakfast, when he was named. And I told him about this experience and how important it was, I thought, that the Treasury be sort of the overall coordinator on behalf of the president of economic policy. And a few weeks later, he called me and he said he agreed with what I had said and he thought he had gotten it implemented, but in a different way. I'm the only cabinet member who goes to all the early White House meetings. And the person who was my assistant when I was working, he came from the White House into the Treasury. The person who was my assistant is still there. And inferentially, he's still my assistant. So I think Rubin also did that. But more lately, the Treasury has seemed to be more an outsider somehow.
Is that just organizational, or is that a different attitude?
I think that hurts because the Treasury brings so much to the party.
Right. But do you think it's basically an organizational difference, or perhaps different administrations put different components into their thinking, let's say nicely?
It may be, but I think it's best when the Treasury it has, just as in the State Department, if the Secretary isn't close to the President and people feel that he or she speaks for the president, then you're not going to do so well. And I think you can see that over the whole history of that post.
Certainly agree with that. Let's talk a little bit about the State Department. It's often thought that, and for good reason, the State Department is the number one department in foreign policy, and the Defense Department's lead in national security. But obviously, those two kinds of policy have much in common, or they meet on many issues. And I wonder whether, how one should think about that relationship between the State Department and the Defense Department.
I think it should be a tight relationship because of the interplay of the ability to do things, not just use force, but to do all kinds of things that the Defense Department can do with your diplomatic efforts. Mm-hmm. I'll give an example. It's totally outside the realm of force. But when the tsunami hit last year, one of the most important things that happened was that our aircraft carriers pulled up nearby and they turned themselves into places where they told everybody not to take a shower, and so all of the water that they basically cleansed got put in bottles, and their choppers put it into places that nobody else could put it. And that was the use of an ability to do something that nobody else could do. And we need to follow that up with our diplomacy with Indonesia, in this case. And I think that's happening. And so the Indonesians see a little something there, and that gives us something to work with diplomatically. Apparently we're in the process of rejuvenating our military-to-military work in the IMET program. And all of this is the interplay of strength and diplomacy, and strength isn't necessarily pulling a trigger. It's the use of your ability to do things that is extraordinary, and they need to be coordinated.
Of course, not all parts of national security policy and even foreign policy have to do with nation states. Terrorism is a good example. I remember very clearly that you really wrestled with the terrorism issue in the case of the war in Lebanon. That was in the early 1980s, and you thought a lot about it, and I wonder whether you think the terrorism challenge is the same, or just broader challenge, or a change challenge, and what your thoughts are today on the subject.
Well, I thought it was a big problem that we weren't appreciating enough when I was in office, and I made a speech in 1984 that called on us to be ready to use preventive force and to beef up our intelligence and such things. It was nervously received. But I can't say that I appreciated what the terrorism threat was all about then. That is, I didn't appreciate how anchored at least a main element is in an extreme version of Islam using that as a weapon and what their objectives were. But now you see that, and it's so you see what you have to do. And what do you have to do? We, a lot of things, but one of them is to learn more about the world of Islam and the variety that's there, and learn how to communicate better. So it isn't just using force somewhere, as in Afghanistan, but it's also interplaying with that carefully worked out set of messages, I think.
But one of the most controversial issues is the issue of preemption, and people have different things in mind. Afghanistan was, you could say, after the fact, although it would preempt later attacks. But what are your thoughts on preemption? That's a big issue today.
Well, I think it's a no-brainer that you have to be to use it. But the question is, what are the conditions that surround it? What sort of intelligence do you demand before you're willing to make that kind of a decision? Because it's a big, important decision. And what sort of alliances do you feel you should have in order to have the world with you as you do whatever it is you do to the extent you can? But in the end, if you see a gathering threat that's clear, you're going to try to stop it because the consequences are so huge these days. And the nuclear dimension of it, I think, is particularly troublesome.
We've lost track of the question that was important at one point, it'll probably be important again, and that's when you're dealing with the just hostage taking. What is the posture that the government should take? Should we be prepared to negotiate with hostages, to make triangular deals with them, or what's the best position to take and carry through with?
The trouble with negotiating and giving something in exchange for the return of a hostage is that you, in effect, create a market for hostages. And so if it works, when I've taken this person, I'll take another person, and it's sort of commerce without end. So I think you can't fall into that trap.
There were plenty of opportunities to fall into that trap in Lebanon, I remember.
And
a number of Americans were taking hostages.
That was what the Iran-Contra business was really all about, in my opinion.
And?
And it turned out to be a disaster.
Right.
Including a hostage would get freed and another one would be taken. So it just had that same characteristic. And President Reagan, at least as I interpret this, really was deeply troubled by the fact that here were these Americans being held in Lebanon, and he's the president of the United States, and he can't seem to do anything about it. So people came to him with what I always thought was a cockeyed idea, that we'd sell a few arms to Iran, and that would turn the Iranian relationship around. And, oh, by the way, Mr. President, we'll also get our hostages out. That was the hook that he couldn't resist. And so he went along with that. And I guess you'd like to feel, if you were a hostage, you'd like to feel that the president is worried about it and wants to work to help you get out. But it got us into a problem. It's interesting that the two biggest tragedies of the Reagan administration both were involving Lebanon. The bombing of the Marine barracks was a terrible moment. Yeah. And the Iran-Contra business was really over the hostages, all right in Lebanon.
Right. I think people recognize that these doctrines, if I can call it that, being prepared to use force, not negotiating with hostages and so forth, over hostages are very important principles. But a lot of success, it seems to me, in foreign policy making, for that matter, in domestic policy making, turn on the qualities of the people who are involved. And of course, intelligence is required. But are there other qualities you think that one can think of when they're thinking about your success? I know I've often said to friends, I thought one of the formative influences that was very important in your later success was that you had a lot of experience as a labor mediator. And there you're dealing with two parties that are opposed, and you've got to bring them together. That happens all the time in foreign policy and in a wartime situation, where particularly where you're dealing with foreign bodies, foreign groups that are fighting each other. And as a labor mediator, you really have to be able to listen and figure out what's motivating each side.
The labor, in your labor mediation case, parties are opposed on something or other, and you're trying to help them work it out. And they know that after it's over, they have to live with each other. The workers are going to get paid by the management to do some work, and the management is expecting the work to be done so they can sell a product, and so on. So there is an ongoing relationship and a problem to be worked out in order to keep that constructive. That gives you an advantage. You have that to work with. And I think in foreign affairs, you have a lot of the same characteristics. And I always felt that one of the most important things to do was what you remember we call gardening.
Right.
That you go around and talk to people in ordinary times. You listen to them. You try to understand how they see the world. And I remember also when I would go around, I'd try to take enough time to say to them, show me something in your country you're really proud of. And they'd like to do that, and you learn a lot from that. So then when something tough comes along, you've laid a groundwork, and you're talking to people that you know, And that doesn't mean they're necessarily going to agree with you, but you don't have unnecessary disagreements. And sometimes even on a personal level, I felt in getting to know my counterpart, Edward Shevardnadze, in the Soviet Union, he wasn't going to do anything different just because we had a decent human relationship, but he wouldn't unnecessarily aggravate things either. And if you had a decent relationship, he could say, look, we're not going to do this, and let me tell you why. Or I remember once when we had our endless arguments about human rights, he said to me once, we might do some of these things that you're asking for, George, but not to please you. Only if it looks right. Sensible to us. You that really got me thinking about them, and we brought in this whole information age. The world is changing. Closed, compartmented societies will fall behind, and therefore you should change your attitude toward all these human rights issues. And that, I won't say that caused all the change, but I think it helped quite a lot. And at one point, I made a very carefully worked out statement, which I usually didn't do in these things. It was written out carefully, and I read it slowly so the Soviet note takers could take it down exactly, because I was hoping they would take that to the to the Politburo and read it out, and apparently they did. And Gorbachev got interested, and he asked that our policy planning group that had been working this material, led by a terrific guy named Dick Solomon, who's now running the U.S. Institute for Peace, and we even had exchange visits. And so I listened to Shevardnadze and tried to figure out how to make what I was asking for fit in with what was good for him.
Those are great illustrations. They have to do with our principal opponent of the period, but you started out right here in North America doing that same kind of gardening, didn't you?
Exactly, and I've always felt that foreign policy starts in your neighborhood. And if you have a healthy neighborhood, you're way ahead of the game and everything else. And if you have a neighborhood where things are going badly, then it's going to be gnawing at you all the time, whatever else you do. And I remember the first trip I took out of the country as Secretary of State was to Canada. There was a lot going on, and the next one was to Mexico. And I remember the trip to Canada on the plane with the press people there, that we had a press conference, as I always do. And basically they were saying to me, what in the hell are you doing going to Canada, for God's sake? And I said, well, who do you think is our biggest trading partner? They all said Japan. Who's next? Germany. Who's next? I don't know. I said, you're also wrong. It's pathetic. Canada is our biggest trading partner, and it isn't even close. And don't forget, Mexico is third. So from an economic standpoint, how many telephone calls do you think there are between Canadians and Americans every day? How many people go across? So we have to nourish these relationships. And you know, I worked at that. Ronald Reagan worked it very hard.
One of the implications of that is that a Secretary of State has to travel a lot. And I remember you felt that one of the problems with travel was that since the big decisions were made in Washington, you were often not there when they were made, and that's a cost of travel. And I know that Secretaries of State since then have had to deal with those trade-offs.
Well, the way you have to deal with that is with people that you have. First of all, you have to have a first-class deputy secretary who you know well and who knows you. So you were deputy secretary, and then when you went off to IBM, as I remember, John Whitehead came. In both cases, when I went on a trip, you were in charge. But we always had a good understanding if something important came up, we'd communicate about it. And so we could work at it that way. But I think you need big people, more big people in the state than you have right now. And the more you have, the better off you're going to be. And your assistant secretaries play a big part. And to have first-class people in these various regional things that can carry the ball, who can walk into a head of government's office and be recognized, not just as they're representing the U.S., but they're people that are known to be big people who you can talk to. And they'll understand what you're saying, and we'll get it back to the secretary or the president or whatever. Well, that's very important.
We were talking about qualities, and I noticed in your book you said that patience was your virtue. This was in connection with one particular occasion, but talk a little bit about patience and its importance, if you think that is important.
Well, I think it's important to be able to take time. Sometimes you don't have a lot of time, so you can't be too, time is not on your side. But the timing of doing something that you want to get accomplished is critical. And there are occasions when you may see clearly what you need to do, but you know the situation isn't ripe for it. So if you wait a little bit, maybe the situation will ripen, and then you can do something that you couldn't do before. So I think patience is important. Silence is important sometimes to use. Be quiet, listen. And it makes people nervous sometimes when you're quiet.
They called you the Sphinx, you know.
They'll talk.
Yeah, right. Right. One thing I've never really understood very well is the stress you've repeatedly put on accountability. And I wonder if you could give maybe a few little illustrations of accountability. Passing the buck seems to be a more important or more often practiced rule in Washington. Talk to me a little bit, if you would, about accountability.
Well, I don't think life works very well. I don't think an economic system works very well. I don't think a security system works very well unless there is accountability. And you learn about accountability a lot from, for instance, sports. Mm-hmm. And sports teaches you, if it's a team sport, it's your responsibility to be in good shape. And then you have your assignment. If it's a football game and you miss your block, the runner gets cut down, team doesn't accomplish what it's doing, and you're accountable, you missed. And when it goes well, it's because people did their jobs. Or there's Tiger Woods on the putting green, and in the end, he has to figure out how hard to hit the ball and what the breaks are. And he hits it, and in the end, the result is unambiguous. The ball is in the hole or it isn't in the hole. No arguments, no referee, accountability. And I think if you have an economic system where when somebody gets in trouble, they get bailed out, then you don't have accountability, and the whole thing deteriorates. I thought that there was a period in our country back some 10 years or so when there was just too much bailing out going on. And when that happens, people say they'll take risks that they wouldn't otherwise take because in the end, if it fails, I'm going to get bailed out. So mm-hmm. I think accountability is very important that way. And of course, the same thing is true in national security affairs. People have to feel it. That if they do something, there'll be a reaction to it. And if you fail, if people are too loose with big words like it's unacceptable, if it's unacceptable, well, that's a big word.
Right.
It means if they try to do it, you're going to stop them from doing it. And you're going to
hold. The worst thing is if you don't.
You're going to hold them accountable. And then if they do it and you don't. Well, the whole thing falls apart. Who should pay attention to you after that? So you have to be really careful. I learned this lesson once from Lee Kuan Yew. Whenever I would go to Singapore, he'd give a dinner for me. And we'd have a lot of conversation. The dinner would break up. And on one occasion, for some reason, he got up at the end and he gave a toast, which I was surprised because he didn't do that. So I gave a little toast, and afterwards I said to him, you hardly ever give toast, but you got up and you gave a toast. Why don't you do that more often? He said, when you give toasts, you almost always it's nice.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be careful, because words are precious. Once you have issued them, you can never get them back.
Right.
Now, there's a man who understands accountability.
Let me ask you just two more questions if we have time. One of them is fairly current, but I remember this came up when you were Secretary of State, and that is the role of democracy as a goal of foreign policy and how you achieve it, if that is your goal, and how you talk about it. Can you have any reflections on that?
Well, I think it's an appropriate goal for us. And mostly we attain it by doing a good job of making democracy work at home. That's the biggest thing you can do. And you want to let the people who want to advocate democracy in their country know that you're on their side. I think the interplay of open political systems, I'll put it that way, and open economic systems is very strong. And so if you're trying to work on democracy, you also want to work on economics together with that effort. One of my colleagues here at Hoover, Harry Roan, has made some interesting calculations. He's sort of gone around the world and said, look, is there some sort of breakout point for the emergence of democratic institutions? And he says, when countries get to a certain income per capita, there's almost a breakover point at that stage. And his idea is being tested at the moment by China, and he's struggling with that. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, the point is there's a real interaction between political openness and economic openness. And so you don't just advocate one, you have to work on both at the same time, I think.
Let me ask you one last question. It's a complicated one, and it's something that I think illustrates many of the principles we've been talking about and that is faced by every administration, every Secretary of State, and that's the peace process, as it's popularly called, between Israel and the Palestinians. I remember you were involved with President Reagan in the Fresh Start initiative when you first became Secretary of State. It made some progress. There have been other initiatives since. Things continue to change, but there are several different views about it, and there are tensions between the Europeans and the United States about what to do about that subject. What are your reflections now, looking back, on how you should look at it, what the U.S. role is, and so forth?
Well, I worked at it hard, and I'm recalling a cartoon in the Jerusalem Post as I was leaving the area once after negotiating or pushing something. And the cartoon had me holding off blows. And on the ground is a piece of paper that said Schultz peace proposals. And an Israeli is there with a club beating on me, and a Palestinian with a club beating on me, and there's a Jordanian with a club beating on me. And the caption says, at least they agree on something. So it's a tough role. And I think that you have to work on possibilities, not probabilities. You say you won't do anything unless it's very probable you'll succeed. You'll never do anything because it's hard, but it's possible. And you try to turn a possibility into a probability. Right now, I think it's a very important but difficult moment. The Israelis have withdrawn from Gaza. And if the party of the current prime minister wins an election next week, he has said they will withdraw from many of the settlements scattered around in the West Bank, not all, but many. So Israel is following a policy of disengaging from the Palestinians. They put up a barrier, and it seems to be working, at least in the sense that the suicide bombings have gone way, way down. And they're saying, we're going to get our security by unilateral action. rather than by negotiation, because there's nobody to negotiate with. And meanwhile, the Palestinians now have Gaza. It's in chaos. And a party has been elected that has pledged itself to eliminate Israel. So that's hardly somebody you want to negotiate with. So it's right now it's a tough situation, and I think you have to have a lot of sympathy with the Israelis and what they're trying to do. As long as they're ready, if the time comes, and that's not right now, to negotiate if the right party comes along.
So there are people who say that the United States should always be active in the peace process. Now, there are various definitions of active, but what's your view on that subject? Are there times when the United States should just watch what's happening and not try to get engaged?
Well, I think you're always engaged. It's a question of with what amount of intensity. But I think it's important to have some balls in the air all the time, because if there aren't, then people give up hope. And if there's no hope, everything deteriorates. I think violence becomes endemic. So you want to keep out there the possibility that there might be something positive happen and that you're ready to work on that. One of the ways that I think is of some significance right now, for instance, is to be looking at economic things. There's a lot of work being done on desalinization, for instance. Water is a critical issue. So try to get some small things going that involve the Israelis and maybe us and Palestinians on how you're going to get more water. Because it's an issue that people fight over. And we know, as an economist, that there is a price at which there's plenty of water. It's just a matter of whether you want to pay that price. The price is desalinization's costs. Those costs have been coming down. But at any rate, some things like that that you can get going, at least a way of showing some hope and showing that if the situation does mature in a positive direction, there are people there who will help move things along. So that's the kind of thing I think right now. But in the meantime, I think Israel deserves support in its effort to get security.
It's a good illustration of the relationship between economic policy and foreign policy in a more political sense. They can mutually reinforce each other, or they can be at odds.
Absolutely.
And also, it's a good illustration, I think, of the fact that the United States is not alone in the world. The Europeans have views on this, as on every other issue, and so we have to work with our allies too. I don't know what your experience has been in the peace process of working with the Europeans. Is that a...
They're very interested, but they were content to let us take the heat.
Right.
But you remember, when I first came into office, the Israelis were overlooking Beirut, and we conducted a negotiation led by a wonderful Foreign Service officer named Phil Habib to get the PLO out of Beirut and the Israelis to move back a little. We did that with the French and the Italians. Mm-hmm. And we went together to provide the force that made that possible. So you can work with them. You can work with the French. They're difficult, but if you can persuade them to do that, they're very good at executing stuff.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, George Shultz. This has been just a wonderful review of your years at the State Department, your general views on policy, and we all appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken.